Okay. I'm going to talk about animating characters with human data. I think maybe following Eugene's example, I'm going to go back a little bit in time and talk about some earlier work. I'm going to try and put a little bit more perspective on this, since it's some of its older work, and talk about the lessons that I think we learned. I'm, of course, not just talking about my work, so I've listed a few of the key collaborators whose work I'm presenting today, or will show you today up here. A couple folks are here. Paul Reitzma is here. Nancy Pollard will talk next. I'll point out particular people's work. And I would love to be interrupted in the middle for questions. I think that would be great. That's the nice thing about this small format, so please do that. So I'm going to talk about animating human motion, and I think many people in this room are interested in this question. Here are the reasons that I'm interested in the question. We, of course, all like to be able to make better computer animations. That's the driving application from entertainment that Eugene talked about. We'd also like to make much better interactive environments, so I've put up an image from a video game here as that example. I've recently gotten interested in physical training, so the next image down is from our motion capture lab, which is a wireless, can also be used as a wireless virtual reality lab. So he's wearing a head mount. He's also wearing a set of markers, so we're tracking full body in real time, which is relatively recent functionality in the passive optical system. And then through that head mount, what he's seeing is his own posture represented some distance away from him, and then also the posture of a teacher who's, this is a Tai Chi training example. So he can see a master Tai Chi in that posture and then be attempting to match it. The question we were looking at is what kind of interface actually makes sense here. How should he see the master's motions? How should he see his motions? Should they be overlaid and so on? And does that make any difference in performance? And we don't really know the answer yet. So far, all of the things we've tried had about equal performance. So there's something else going on that we don't understand. But this is another place where being able to animate human motion is obviously important to be able to represent these characters. And finally, my background's in robotics. I'll show you a few clips from that era. And I've recently sort of come full circle. So I started out doing robotics, spent a lot of time doing animation. I'm about to come back to robotics. We just got a big award to buy a humanoid robot that'll be a little bit like this one, but it'll actually have, I hope, have legs and be able to walk around. So that's very exciting for me, and that's sort of the new direction that we're going to move in. And the results that we have here, I hope, will all work, you know, obviously with some additional effort, on these humanoid robots. So I think I can bring these problems back together again. So this is an example. We need volume, yeah. This is an example from about 1987, work with Mark Rabert at CMU and then at MIT. This is a planar biped robot. It can't fall out of the circle, but can fall on its nose. All these wires you can see in the center are carrying the hydraulic power supply, the connection to the control computer, which in those days was a VAX. But now, obviously, you put it on board, and power, electrical power, and things like that. So the cool thing about the flip was actually that all I had to do was push a button, and then the system knew to jump extra high, throw the body downward here, bring in the legs to reduce the moment of inertia, and then it could land again using the normal running algorithm. So the cool thing about it was that, with the exception of a couple of additional actions, the control algorithms that worked for running actually worked for doing the flip. This was some of my thesis work on rough terrain locomotion. The idea was to land on that red piece of red tape before the step, and then on approximately the center of each step on the way up. So it was a step length control problem, very simple kind of rough terrain. It knew where the blocks were. There was no vision problem, no planning problem, and none of those sorts of things. So what did we learn from this work? I think one of the important lessons was that very simple control algorithms actually worked very well for these kinds of relatively simple machines. So there was a series of machines. Some of them were three-dimensional. Some of them were one-legged, two-legged, and four-legged. But for all of these machines, for the most complicated behaviors we implemented on them, the control code was only 100 or so, 200 lines of code. It was really a very short piece of code. I'm separating out all the stuff about writing to the valves and reading the sensors and all that kind of junk, because that's sort of boilerplate. But the meat of it, the part with real domain knowledge about the behavior that it was doing, the real control algorithms, were only a few hundred lines. So I think that's an important lesson in the sense that we could construct pretty robust control algorithms that worked on real physical hardware You know, I had joystick control over that biped, and we used to have all sorts of people come to the lab, little kids and deans and all sorts of people were capable of driving this thing. So the control code was really pretty robust for these simple behaviors, yet it was also very short. So I think that's an important lesson. If we can figure out the right answer, I think it actually won't end up being that many lines of code for these kinds of systems. And the other important lesson is that passive dynamics, I think, really helped to produce behaviors for these things. So they were effectively designed to be a mass spring system, which meant when we dropped them on the ground without any real computer control at all, they were going to bounce back up and they were going to have some of the behaviors of running in them just from the passive behaviors of the system. And so I think that as we go on to, you know, combine together simulation and motion capture and do these other things, we need to remember that the passive dynamics of the system really does matter. So the next thing that we did was to say, okay, we can do this with the real robots. Can we actually do it in simulation? And is that of any actual value to the graphics or animation community? So this is from now 1991. It was in the Electronic Theater in 1991. It was close to the last hardware-rendered thing that was ever in the Electronic Theater, I believe. So the two robots there we had actually built, as well as built these simulations of them. The Uniroos are these one-legged kangaroos. They are planar, so they can't fall sideways. That's why they have only are drawn with only one leg. Ostriches were a very complicated system simulation, and they actually only ran for about 5 seconds or 10 seconds at a time. So we had all these short clips, which weren't there for cinematic reasons, but were there because the simulations actually didn't run as long as we might have liked them to. I remember Mark and I had this really long debate about whether to put that cheesy crash in, and I was voting no, and he was voting yes, and so clear he was right. Okay, so what's going on here? Whether we're doing robotics or we're doing animation, we've got a block diagram that looks something like this. The user specifies a desired behavior, so do a flip or run in this direction at this velocity. That's input to this control code that's going to spit out forces and torques. We'll apply that either to the model, the dynamic model, or to the machine. In the case of the model, integrate it forward in time, get the new state of the system, feed it back to the control, and play it back to the graphics. We built all of our control systems as this hierarchy that's down in the lower left-hand corner. So there was a state machine at the top that was figuring out what the system ought to, what state the system was in right now. So is it in flight trying to position a leg for touchdown? Is it on the ground pushing off? What's going on? And then those were usually fairly easy to construct given a small amount of domain knowledge about the behavior. The next thing down with the green arrows is what was important. That's what we called control actions. And that went from the state of the system to figuring out what should be happening with the hip joint at this state in the system. So the foot's planted on the ground, it's running, it's trying to push off. What should be happening with, you know, the knee joint or something like that, in order to make it continue running in a balanced fashion and achieve its goals. And that was where all the domain knowledge went in. So that's where we spent all of our time, was trying to figure out what those equations should be, that the hip angle should be some function of the forward speed and so on. And then there were some low-level servos that just tried to actually achieve those desired angles, and those were also fairly straightforward. So the lessons learned here. Dinesh just reminded me that in a talk a few years ago, Mark Rebert actually said that originally he thought simulation was for sissies. And that's right. He, in all of the work that we did, we controlled those robots without ever having implemented any of the control code in simulation. The claim, what we thought at the time, was that we couldn't build accurate enough simulations, and so the control code wouldn't port very well over to the robots anyway if we did it in first in simulation. But we did debug all the stuff on the robots in simulation. So the first one is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but what we learned from this work was that we could make these robot control algorithms work not just on the robots, but actually in simulation, which probably isn't a surprise to anybody. The other lesson was that correct dynamics don't give you a character with personality and expressive movement and things like that, especially if it has only a few degrees of freedom. So, you know, people respond to the movie I just showed you, the kangaroo movie, but it doesn't tell a very powerful story. It doesn't have anything like the kind of expressiveness that you would obviously expect from a Pixar movie or something like that. So we got a lot of the details of the motion out of the dynamics, but we didn't have all the extra degrees of freedom that you would need to really have personality and style. So the next step was to say, can we make any of this work for humans, and how much more complicated will the control algorithms be there? So this is from 1996. This is some of the work I did at Georgia Tech. The Olympics were in Atlanta in 1996, so we had kind of an Olympic theme. The rule of my lab at that point was that everything we drew on the screen was physically simulated, so that's true for those flags in the wind, as well as, of course, for these human characters. We also had some coupled simulations, so the kind of splash that the diver generates depends on the way that he actually enters the water. So what do we learn here? We learned that we could do the design of these control systems for human behaviors. We also learned it wasn't very easy. I sort of cut the credits off there, but the list of credits on that movie is pretty long, and basically one student did most of each of those simulations. So it was a lot of work went into the design of those simulations. And by the time we finished designing any particular control algorithm for behavior, we knew an awful lot more about that behavior than we did before we started. So there's nothing very automatic about that process. We had a set of tools, and you know, it was a little easier to do the fifth one than it was to do the first one, but it was still a lot of work to do each of those simulations. The other lesson there, I think, is that human motion has an awful lot of subtleties in it, stylistic elements in it, and it's really hard to model those. We don't have a programming language in any sense that allows us to try and control those kinds of behaviors. And then finally, of course, an observation that many people have made is that our standards for human motion are really very high. We're very attuned to watching how people move, and so we apply very high standards. And I think the more realistic the rendering style, the higher the standards are that are applied as well. So, it sort of takes me to some of the newer work. Because there's so many subtleties in human motion and the dynamics doesn't give us enough constraints on how the person should actually move, we need more information about how people should move. And I think this is an observation that has been made, you know, over the last 5 or so years in rendering as well. We need a lot more data. We're sort of past the phase of trying to recreate the world from scratch, and we're now at the point of trying to capture the world, and then I assume that the next step will be to, you know, use an intelligent combination of recreation and data from the real world to actually be able to build the virtual worlds that Eugene referred to. So we built a motion capture lab at CMU. It's a pretty big space, although of course it's never a big enough space. So it's 55 feet long, which is great. It's only 25 feet wide, which sort of restricts some of the things that we can capture. But we can do pretty well. We can capture a region that's about 10 feet by 20 feet long in that space. We have a Vicon M-camera system. The M-cameras aren't now the most latest cameras, but they're high resolution and 120 hertz, so they're really quite nice cameras. We have 12 of them, so we can now do capture of two people in the space at the same time. And we can then use, because of the resolution of the cameras, both in time and in space, we can use quite small markers. So we can use 14-millimeter markers. So I took this picture with a flash. It looks like those markers are huge. They're actually much smaller, but they're retroreflective, so when I used the flash, they bloomed in the image. So the question is, now that we can get really very nice data of how people move, what should we be doing with it? And I think there's a whole sort of spectrum of interesting problems that range between sort of pure motion capture data and figuring out what to do with that, all the way down to sort of pure simulation. And then I think there are various interesting sweet spots in the middle there where we can combine these two techniques together to get a very powerful set of approaches. So I'm going to talk about a couple of things that fall in the middle here. I'm going to start down at the left-hand end, and we'll start by talking about something that's based almost completely on motion capture data. I'm not going to talk about related work in detail. There obviously is a lot. Some of the great work was done by folks in this room, like Michael. I've sort of loosely divided things into four boxes. Systems, rule-based systems being ones that where you try to extract principles about how people move and encapsulate them in rules and then be able to produce animations from that. In the early days of motion capture, we had relatively few examples of motion capture data, so I call those example-based because they're trying to build off of a relatively small library, a few motions at a time. Over in the right-hand corner, I call the probabilistic statistical models. I think this is now pushing towards some of the learning techniques that Eugene talked about, but we now have much bigger databases of motion capture data, and there are a lot of things we can do that we couldn't do before. And then the upper right-hand corner is control system techniques, like some of the examples that I just showed you, and I have one more example coming toward the end. So this is the kind of data that we're going to work with. This instructions to this subject were walk around on the floor. It was about 5 minutes of data total. Walk forwards, walk backwards, walk sideways. But those were all the instructions that we gave to him. And then we end up with these long segments of data, roughly 5 minutes or so at a time, where he has just done all of these things in sequence. So it's not segmented in any way. It's just a long sequence of data. And what we would like to get out of that is an interface that looks something like this. So here, the user is sketching this pink line, and then the character is walking around, grabbing different pieces of data from this database to be able to approximately follow that pink line. And we'd like, of course, for him to be able to figure out puzzles like that, like how to turn through there. That particular motion looks really great. It looks like he has to think about what to do to move between those two things. That's, of course, an accident, and there are other examples where it looks like he's just dithering around instead of thinking intelligently. I think there are probably some of those in this clip coming up. So sometimes the behavior will end up looking really good because of the way it moves to the database. Sometimes there won't be exactly the right segments of data in the database or the right transitions in the database, and he'll end up taking extra actions that no person would have taken in that situation. So what's going on here is that we've captured data wandering around in the space. That's over on the left-hand side. We now have this new virtual environment that had nothing to do with the space the person was actually moving in. They were just walking on a clear, open area. And we want to be able to sketch out a path through that and fix up any problems with the path, like the overlap with that obstacle, and end up grabbing the right pieces of data out of the database in order to be able to follow that trajectory. So, we've taken different pieces of data in the database and then resequenced them in body local coordinates to be able to move this character around in the space. So a little bit more of the details. We've started out with these long sequences of data, and so each of those gold dots represents a pose and velocity for the character. So it's a 70-something dimensional yellow dot there. And then we have long sequences of data, which are obviously much longer than I'm showing here. This is a schematic representation. So the insight that we had, as well as a couple of other folks at SIGGRAPH this year, was that you could draw lines in these sequences of data between points that were quite similar. And then what you basically end up with is a screensaver. So the character can wander around in this graph forever. If the graph is big enough, the motion won't look repetitive. It should look pretty good. And all of the motion should look good in the sense that there shouldn't be any really jarring transition. So if we only drew those white arrows in the appropriate places to draw them where the character's pose was similar enough, then we should always have good-looking motion, and it should basically be able to wander around forever in this space. And obviously, you have much more generality there than you have from those sequences that are up on the top. There's some details there. One of the details is, when should we draw one of those white arrows? What does it mean for two poses to actually be similar enough? What we looked at was the pose of the character, so a set of the joint angles, not all the joint angles, but most of the many of the joint angles. Looked at the velocities of those joints, and then also looked at the contact state. We didn't test a lot of other things, and one of the sort of lessons from this, I think, from our work and also some of the related papers that were at SIGGRAPH this year, was that we all made a lot of engineering decisions without really stepping back and analyzing. I mean, we made good enough decisions to get our systems to work, obviously, but without stepping back to analyze those decisions. So one of the things I hope will happen is that people will step back a little bit and look at some of those decisions like this one, what makes a good transition, and then have more other things to say about that. So then the next step is to actually search to find the path. So we've got the screensaver, but now we actually want to control the character. We want him to be following that pink line, and so we want to find a path through this, search to find a path through this space to actually find that line. And that, for the size of the databases that we were looking at, was mostly fairly straightforward. In some of the later examples, we were using clustering to try and make that a little bit easier, faster. We can do other examples. This is a rough terrain example, so you can see the size of the capture region that we have there. So we built a set of rough terrain blocks of a couple different heights. We can reconfigure them, and we asked him to walk around on that space. We simplified this a little bit. We asked him to only turn 90 degrees when he turns, so that reduces the state space of the problem and makes it significantly easier to do. And then we can take that and extend it to a much larger section of rough terrain here. It's the same, similar kind of interface to the path interface, except we've specified a goal with that pink circle. The user specified a goal, and then our character makes his way over there. One of the things we'd like to know is how good a job does this motion do of matching up to what a person would do in this situation. So here we've asked somebody in a mocked-up example from the maze to walk through that terrain, recorded her motion directly, and then we'll compare it to the motion of our character. So here we have the synthesized motion on the left-hand side and the recorded motion on the right-hand side, and we'd like to know, you know, how similar is what she did in the actual terrain to what we were able to synthesize for the character from terrain, from examples where he wasn't actually walking in the rough terrain. There are a couple of differences. She looks down at her feet a little more to try and ensure that she doesn't stubbing her toes. He's not going to do that because he was walking on flat terrain. He wasn't worrying about stubbing his toes. So there's some subtle differences, but many of the strategies are the same. We obviously need to do a much more thorough job of trying to assess the quality of the motion there. So I just showed you a couple of interfaces. This sketching interface on both the maze and the poles and holes rough terrain. We also wanted to look at an interface that would work on a piece of playground equipment. Slide's a little dark, but basically this playground equipment has a number of different ladders. So there are a lot of different behaviors that the character can do there. And it didn't seem to make so much sense to be sketching paths on it because you can do all sorts of different things, different behaviors on this piece of playground equipment. So the thought was that maybe what we needed was to show the user a set of choices that they had available at any moment in time, and then they could sort of cycle through those and pick one as a way of controlling the character. So this is an example of what the interface looks like. The gray character is the current position of the avatar. The green and the pink characters are the ones that the user could choose among. The pink one is the one that's currently chosen, and these arrows show the path to the pink character, roughly the path that the character will take to get to that configuration. And here's an example of this running. So you need to be showing a couple of examples to the user at any time. You obviously don't want things flashing on and off the screen too fast, or it won't work as an interface. Too many characters won't work as an interface either. It'll just be too complicated. So you could control in time and in space how far ahead you were looking to see which characters to which characters should be shown to the user. So you can make the view show more examples of behaviors or fewer examples of behaviors at a particular time. So we needed a little bit of extra technology for this, and that was to group together the behaviors into clusters so that we could then represent them to the user. So at any moment, we want to see three distinct actions that are reasonable ones that the character could get to in the next 5 seconds or so. So we can take the same database of motion and put together poses that are similar, and then represent those, pick a representative pose from those and show that to the user. So that's what's drawn on the bottom. We still have the same graph structure from before, but what now we've also taken these poses and grouped them together. And again, we have a decision to make about what like really means in that situation. And then given this clustering, we can figure out what clusters the character can get to in a reasonable, within this time window, and then the end clusters of those will be the things that are actually displayed as the green and pink characters. So if he's currently sitting in A, he can move to cluster B, and from B to A, C, and D. So the things that are actually shown to the user then would be representative poses for A, C, and D. And what we hope is that if we've done a good job of this clustering, then those really will be representative poses. They'll all show things like, you know, walking on the ground or climbing a ladder or, you know, a class of poses that or a class of activities that people would recognize as being similar. So what did we learn from this? Well, we learned from this that a lot of people were thinking about the same problem this year. So there were a couple of SIGGRAPH papers that were all on quite closely related topics. And it was interesting, actually, to see how everybody had a slightly different take on this problem. I think probably in part this is coming from the fact that graphics is so driven by the available technology. And it's only been in the last couple of years that academics have actually been able to buy high-quality motion capture systems, both to have the funding and to have them actually available on the market. And I think it's only with that and a little bit more release of free data that people have actually been able to build substantial libraries. So in retrospect, it's probably not that surprising that we all started thinking about the same problems, about similar problems at about the same time, because the technology was driving what data was actually available to us. The databases may not need to be as big as we would have guessed, or at least I would have guessed in advance. So most of the examples that I've just shown you were driven from 5 to 10 minutes worth of data. So that's not a huge amount of data if you actually think about representing human behavior. Now, each of those is, of course, a limited domain, walking around on the ground, climbing on the playground equipment, and so on. We weren't spanning the space of all human behavior, but I was still surprised at how densely populated that graph could end up being with relatively small amounts of data. So we always think of, you know, human data as being in this very high-dimensional space, but in fact, we're only operating in a very small part, a relatively small part of that space. So maybe these databases don't have to be as big or as unmanageable as we would have thought in advance. There were various insights in the papers. One of the ones I thought was quite interesting was from the Berkeley paper, where they kept around more transitions. So this was a subtlety I didn't really talk about, but when you're generating those transitions in the white graph, you can decide how many of them you want to keep around, how dense do you want the transition space to be. We culled our set of transitions quite heavily, as did Michael Gleischer at Wisconsin. The folks at Berkeley didn't and then clustered on transitions, so they were able to do much more exact search than we were able to do. So I thought that was an interesting insight that maybe even though those transitions are almost the same, maybe you still want to keep them around because they give you slightly different information when you're actually trying to search for a particular path. All of us made an awful lot of engineering decisions, which we haven't really gone back and analyzed yet. So I've listed a couple of them down here. What makes a good transition, I already talked about. We tried some particular clustering techniques and demonstrated they had some value in the search problems that we did. But it would be nice to go back and say, you know, are those the right kinds of techniques to be using? You know, we could be using hashing. There are lots of other things we could be doing. And maybe on particular databases or particular behaviors, other techniques would work much better. And I don't think any of us yet thought really hard about scaling both in storage and in search time. So, you know, I said that I don't think the databases have to be as big as I would have thought a priori, but they still have to be pretty big, and we're going to run out of, at least in the next couple of years, we're going to run out of enough memory and CPU time to be able to search these, especially for interactive environments. The next thing I want to talk about is another kind of interface that we can put on top of this database. We call this a performance interface. So here the user is going to perform in front of a camera. In this example, it's a single camera. I think ultimately it should be two or three cameras, probably. And then we'll extract some information about that, silhouettes in this case, and then search the database to find motion that's similar to what she was doing in this example. So this is a very simple example in that she's just interacting with a step stool. Obviously, there's a limited repertoire of things that you can do, but we're able to pull out a good match to her behavior almost all of the time. Sometimes there's some left-right confusion since there's only a single camera. And if we don't have the right thing in the database to closely match what she's doing, it's going to hopefully get a similar match. So in the example I'm about to show you, there's one moment where she kind of jumps off the step stool, and the only motion, the closest motion in the database was more of a controlled step off the step stool. And that's what the system found. So the important idea here is that we're always going to get good-looking motion for this avatar that's over on the right-hand side. But we may not always get an exact fit. So it's a much easier problem than the motion tracking problem where we would be directly looking at just the video and trying to understand, you know, what her elbow angle was. It's going to be a much easier problem than that because we're just pulling the right motion out of the database. So that's the video image. We extract her silhouette. Then we also have rendered, pre-rendered silhouettes from a bunch of different camera angles for the motion database. And then we're doing a matching between those two to get her motion. In the current implementation of the system, there's a 3-second delay, so we're accurately showing that to you here. And then we have obviously a lot of ideas on how to fix that. So right now it's taking a 3-second clip of motion to be able to match a long enough segment of motion. But it's real time other than the 3-second delay. So this is a little more detail on how this is working. We're taking this 3-second window in time. So over on the right-hand side, we have 3 seconds of her motion extracted to silhouettes. And then we have, using this clustering technique that I talked about earlier, we have an idea of where this character might be able to go from the current position. So that's, you know, sitting in cluster A, these are the different clusters that it can actually get to. And then we'll look at the rendered sequences for those clusters, for following those paths, and compare the two and try and understand which one is the best representation of her motion. It's not totally independent of the camera view. It was rendered from a number of different camera views in advance, but we were making assumptions about the height of the camera and the angle and so on. So obviously, if you want to do more there, you'd need to figure out the camera parameters probably on the fly. One of the things that we're doing now is trying to extend this to other systems, and in particular, one of the extensions would be to facial animation. So this is a very similar kind of setup, except now we're looking at facial animation instead of whole body motion. So we can capture, again, good motion of the face using the current commercial technology that we have. We can do a certain amount of offline pre-processing of the data and end up with a database of expressions and facial motions. And then we hope that we'll be able to track the user in front of a single camera again, or maybe two cameras, remove the rigid body motion of the head, and then be able to find motions in the database that are a close match to what she was actually doing. So I don't have any results from this yet. I just thought I'd show you how far we've gotten so far. So we can do quite good facial capture. This is a very simple face model. But animated with data that we've captured in the lab. And then we have some techniques for tracking. We'll just show you this one. For tracking 17 points on the face, which we hope to then use to be able to match into the database. And we can also, this previous clip, PowerPoint just 8. All right, I'm going to give up. There was a previous clip that showed you that we could also extract the rigid body orientation of the head and subtract that out of the motion. So the step stool example, I think, showed us that the problem could be a good deal easier than the actual tracking, vision tracking problem that many people have worked on. What we don't know, obviously, is how extensible this is going to be to more complicated domains like the step stool example. We don't know whether it'll scale to a much bigger set of behaviors, and that's a question we need to answer. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is, we just talked about the motion capture database, now I want to talk about some things that move down toward the simulation end of things. So we're going to be thinking about how to get dynamic collisions into data, into the animated motion that we have. That's really hard to do with straight motion capture data because anything that isn't a line between the capture session that you did and the playback is going to give you errors in the dynamic collision. So even for kinematic contact, but that's easier to fix. So if I rest my hand on this table and there are any errors in the capture or the skeleton of the animated character doesn't match my skeleton, then my hand will look like it's through the table or not. And it's even more true for dynamic collision. And then we're going to look at modifying an existing control system to try and make it more like the style of motion capture data that we have. This is the work of Victor Zordon, who just took a faculty position at UC Riverside. He was one of my students at Georgia Tech. So the idea behind his work is that we're going to start with data of people, and we're going to run it through a dynamic simulation in the hopes of being able to get a responsive character out on the other side. So we'll look at a couple of examples. Ping pong is one, and boxing will be another. The key questions here are how do we go from this data to a working controller? His answer to that question was to use trajectory tracking to be tracking the data with a simulation. And then in the places, and that works fine for the upper body, but for the lower body, balance has to be a concern as well. If you just track the data, the character will fall over. So he had a scheme for averaging between the constraints of balance, which are coming from a control system, and the trajectory, and averaging with the motion capture trajectory. And then there's another question of, we want to be able to control this character, so we want to be able to handle deviations. We need to be able to deviate from the motion capture data. And so some of those kinds of deviations can be predicted. For instance, for the ping pong player, we want him to be able to hit any reasonable incoming ball trajectory. And so then we can use interpolation and inverse kinematics to be able to meet the task constraints, be at the right place to hit the ball for that incoming ball trajectory. And then some of the deviations from the data will be unexpected. So in the boxing example, obviously we don't have data of a person actually being hit, and so we need to simulate those dynamic collisions with then a slow return to some sort of normal behavior. This is an example of whole body tracking. So the full thing is a simulation. It's a rigid body simulation. And the upper body can track the motion capture data, but the lower body then has to respond to what's happening there. Obviously, the moving around of the upper body will cause disturbances in the balance. But we also want the lower body to have something to do with what the character was doing, what the motion capture data said. So there's a working control system for balance, which can then also take, as part of its input, a trajectory for what the lower body was doing. It's basically averaging between the joint angle specified by the balance controller and the joint angle specified by the motion capture data to be able to allow it to stand up and to remain balanced and move around and move the upper body around. We can combine this together to get boxing with an opponent. In order to be able to do that, let's see, I wouldn't let them capture real boxing in the lab because I was worried. So everything that was captured was either boxing with a hanging bag or shadow boxing just against the air. So in order to be able to actually put together the two characters boxing with each other, Victor needed to be able to control the character so that he could actually throw a punch to a particular location. And the way that he did that was to take a library of motion capture hits and to interpolate among them and then use inverse kinematics so that the punch would actually land in the right place. And this is an example of the kind of performance that he was able to achieve. So the targets are zeros, and then the pluses and the X's are left and right punches trying to hit those targets. So for a reasonable range of areas that he might want the character to throw a punch, he got pretty good performance out of this technique, while keeping the motion looking natural, we hope. And this is a comparison with some real-world footage, just sort of give you a sense of how well we were doing. Yeah.
Doing like flops in response to
No, that's
being boxed, or was that being done by the balance?
That's being done by the simulation. I'm actually going to talk about that in just a minute. I was going to talk about control with one more example first. But yes, I wasn't willing to let them punch people in the lab. And if you just are, well, at least if most of us were just performing that, it's probably not going to look that natural. So that all came from simulation. Certainly, I mean, EA obviously does hire people to do these kinds of things. You know, they can hire stunt people and so on. They don't have to deal with human use boards and things like that. Let's see. So the other control example I wanted to do was table tennis. Let me see if PowerPoint will play this again. So again, we'd like to have two people playing table tennis back and forth. And so we want to be able to control the ball, place that the ball goes on the table. So we'd like the character to be able to hit reasonable incoming ball trajectories to in a controlled fashion to different locations on the table. So this is very similar. Again, we have a library of ping pong swings that we've recorded, and then we're going to interpolate among those to get a much denser library. His library actually ended up being relatively sparse, and one of the questions I think that deserves some further thought is how dense should that library actually be for the best performance. But his library ended up being, I think it was about 20 swings, and then he was interpolating quite densely among those swings. So he could then pick the best interpolated swing, which hopefully is still human-like, and then use inverse kinematics to hit the ball and also control the velocity. So there are a number of things that have to be adapted here for a particular incoming ball trajectory. One of them is the joint angles have to be moved, hopefully not too much, but a little bit, in order to actually have the paddle in the right place. And then you need some sort of smooth in, smooth out to return back to the motion capture trajectory. That's what's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side is a scaling in time for a scaling in velocity where we want the character to actually be hitting the ball with the right speed of the racket. And that's, again, an ease-in, ease-out kind of a thing. Here's the level of performance. This is the end of a ping-pong table over on the left-hand side, so the X's are the spots that the character was aiming for. And the cloud of white points shows the performance in terms of hitting around there. And then on the right-hand side shows the control of the velocity of the racket at the moment of contact. You can see it sort of tails off at the end. But it has pretty good control through a fairly wide range of velocities that we needed to see the character achieve for reasonable ping-pong playing. And here's the two characters playing back and forth. They didn't end up with as wide a variety of hits as obviously as we would have liked. So they're definitely basement ping pong quality ping pong players, but they could hit the ball back and forth for a number of times. Okay, the next topic, the answer to your question was adding in dynamic collisions. So these are a couple of examples. You can't see the one on the left hand side, but the one on the right hand side, we have this glove coming in from outer space to molest this guy here and poke at him, and he responds then to the ways that he's being poked. So he's, again, a dynamic simulation. He's following some sort of dancing, fidgeting kind of behavior, but then responding also to the fact that he's being poked. So this is a place where we can actually offer a fair amount of control to an animator or to a user in the way that a character will respond to a collision. So it's a simulation that's tracking the data at first, and then as soon as the collision occurs, it's going to obviously deviate from the data, and then there are questions of how much do you let it deviate from the data, so how much do you want the guy to throw his head back or to allow his head to be thrown back by the punch, and how quickly do you want him to return to whatever kind of idling behavior he had. And so this is a graph showing a couple of different examples. This blue line here is the motion capture data. The normal tracking is the solid line here. There's a collision that occurs, obviously, at this moment in time, and then we can have the character have a very loose response to the collision and be pushed quite far off course, or a much tighter response. And then we can also control the red lines there, show different responses to how fast the character tries to return back to the original behavior. So what did we learn from this work? We learned that data definitely helps with control, but we still have a lot of work to do on the control side. And I don't think we've yet answered how much data do we really need, even for particular behaviors, much less in a more general situation. I guess, again, here I was surprised that we could get away with as little data as we could for these behaviors. So there were not all that many ping-pong swings that were actually captured, yet it seemed to basically be sufficient. We didn't see a lot of motion. We weren't interpolating in such a way that we got motion that looked unnatural. And I guess in advance would have thought we would need more motion to more different individual swings to be able to say that. And then we can add in these collisions to motion capture data and actually get some kind of nice handles for changing the quality of the motion that results from the collisions. Yeah. I didn't say why. I observed that not too much data was needed. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, and I think we need to be thinking about the answer. I don't know it. I mean, there are a bunch of questions there, right? We'd like to know that the clusters, we might like to know whether the clusters are clustering things in a perceptually useful way. Like, if I just show you a whole cluster, are you actually going to tell me that, yeah, those things, I would have put those things in the same bucket? Or if we had you classify things in advance, are we putting things in anything like the same buckets you would have put them in? I mean, that would be one question to try and answer. And there should be some way to try and more rigorously assess how much data we actually need for, you know, what is enough data for at least a particular implementation and a particular behavior. So.
Did you have any experiences with sort of too much data? Because I would imagine that it can't be a situation where having too much data starts to
Right. Everything we looked at came from one subject, so I think that's going to make that a little bit less likely. I think it could be that if you had multiple subjects who had different, distinctly different styles for performing particular tasks, maybe you would get more conflicting information. But we didn't see anything like that, is I guess the short answer to the question. But I think you might be more likely to see it if you were bringing in either giving your subject instructions so you had different styles, or if you were bringing in lots of different people who would just naturally have different styles. And in none of these examples did we look at that. All the data came from one person.
So. Just to break down on the other bike, if you took out the collisions, so for the collisions, that's the dynamics, you obviously giving you something, but for the ping pong player, I'd imagine that you would just a kinematic model would help.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm quite sure you could have done the ping pong player kinematically. So you know how theses evolve. But we started out saying we wanted to think about the collisions. We wanted to do the ping pong example as a first thing. But I mean, Wiley and Hahn showed a long time ago that for these sort of simple reaching motions, that you actually didn't need all that much data, and you could interpolate and get something that could reach or point. Forgotten exactly what the example was, but you know, point to in a very natural looking way. And ping pong is a little more sophisticated than that because there's an element of the velocity in it. And it was nice to be able to say this is a dynamic simulation. The ball is a dynamic simulation. We have an interaction with the racket. You know, the ball is bouncing off the racket in a plausible way. So it was nice to be able to say all that rather than having to kludge, you know, the way the ball bounces off the racket. But I can't tell you that the simulation had a big impact on what you could see in the motion.
I'm wondering if it's more boxing where you can actually kind of separate out the lower body control just to have a motion graph, something motion graph like on the bottom, and then when the boxer gets whacked, you just look up in the motion graph and say whether that whacked in this direction before or if it responds this way. And maybe get a wider set of responses from the lower body.
Right. So I guess I think that it will be very hard to have enough data for that. I mean, I have an example that's coming up in a couple minutes, which is very preliminary work, but, you know, two football players crashing, you know, colliding together. You know, if you're assuming this is an interactive environment and the direction of the velocity they're running at is controlled by the user and so on, it seems like you can't ever have enough data to be able to accurately show how they should fall on the floor. So that seems like an example where, you know, the stuntman seems like an example where you can, it would be useful to be able to switch to simulations. So, yeah. So we haven't done too much recently on higher level behaviors. The claim that everyone who does this kind of work makes, and it may not be true, is that you could just tack the higher level behaviors on the top and then use this as the way that those behaviors are actually achieved. It's almost certain to not be that simple in the end. I think there'll have to be more, you can't have a really strict hierarchy, there'll have to be more communication between the levels. So we've thought a little bit about trying to build models of the functionality of the lower level behaviors so that the higher level behaviors could have a better model of what might be achievable at this moment. I mean, there might be a perfectly good ducking behavior, but you're not in a posture where this is where you can actually do that at this moment. And so the higher level behaviors, in order to make an intelligent decision about what evasive maneuver to take or whatever, we'll need to know more about the state of the system and the capabilities it has at this moment, because it may not have every, it may not be able to achieve every behavior in its repertoire. So. Okay. I'm going to show just a couple more quick examples of some work that's all very rough, very much in progress. So the first one's actually more, a little bit more on dynamic collisions. These are these football players that I just talked about. So what's going on here is something that makes people laugh, which I haven't quite figured out. But what's going on is that we have two characters who are motion captured data up until a moment when they collide and then become dynamic simulations and they fall on the floor. So there's nothing particularly new in what's going on here, but we wanted to understand what happened was when you took these characters and you transitioned from motion captured data to collisions. And there's lots of things, obviously, that are missing. Presumably that's what's leading to the laughter. They aren't particularly aware of each other before they actually collide. So that clearly indicates that we need to be modifying the motion capture data in advance. There's a slightly different example. We need to be modifying the motion capture data in advance so they're a little bit more aware of what's happening. They ought to, of course, roll over and get up. There's been some nice work on that here. So instead of lying on the floor when they're done. So there are lots of, I think the passive collision gives us, can give us nice looking motion in this situation as well, but it's clearly not enough. We need to know more about, the characters need to act more aware of what's happening to them so that they're either dodging or aggressively tackling or whatever it is, that behavior that's appropriate for the situation. So they need to be taking action in anticipation of the collision and probably also various kinds of reflexive responses to the fact that they're actually falling. And then the last example is sort of more down toward this end. Actually, it's not the last example, but it's the next example. It's a walking behavior. So the character is, we're taking motion capture data of human walking, and we're trying to use that to control a simulation of human walking. So there is an existing control system, but it's playing a somewhat smaller role than it was in some of the previous work. So it's down a little bit more toward this trying to design new control systems based on data. So you're seeing two things here. They're about to separate, but the back one is the motion capture data. This is a simulation in the front. So we've gotten some of the properties of human walking, and we're clearly also missing some. So one of the things that's happening here is we're not getting a double support for some reason off the walking motion. And so he's got a little bit more of a bounce in his step than the motion capture data does, or than he ought to. So one of the directions I'd like to push in is trying to more aggressively figure out how to build these control systems automatically from data. So the lessons here, this is remaining challenges really, this is very much in progress, is we don't yet understand enough about walking, and nor do we understand how to make control systems from data in an automatic way. So the last couple of clips I'm going to show you have to do with animating non-humanoid characters. The basic observation here is that motion capture doesn't always work when you have to hire non-standard actors. This is from a image from Motion Analysis. Apparently this elephant ate a lot of the markers during the shoot. And what I'd like to look at is seeing whether we can take, we have a big untapped pool of talent in some sense, which are all these actors who are really good at expressing things with their bodies, expressing emotions, and so on, but we can only use them to animate humans or very close to human-like characters. So is there any way that we can assist them and basically amplify their behaviors appropriately, or scale back, but mostly amplify their behaviors to make them work on very non-humanoid characters? So this is an actor. We hired him and told him to be a prairie dog. So you can make your own decision about how good a prairie dog he is. So I think he's amazingly compelling when you watch the videotape of him. But what I'm going to show you on the next slide is taking his motion and playing it back through a cartoon character of a prairie dog. And I don't think the motion looks nearly as compelling. And, you know, we've scaled it down now to be this small character, but just played back the motion. It doesn't really look all that great, I think. Even though it did when he actually performed it. I mean, you could see the prairie dog in him, or I feel I can see the prairie dog in him when he performs, but I don't see it so much in that cartoon character. So the question that we're trying to answer is whether you can amplify his motion. And this is, again, just very preliminary work, but this is some scaling based on some strength models where his motion is basically sped up because the prairie dog is a much smaller creature. He should move at a much higher frequency than a person does, so we can speed up his motion. Actually play. We could speed up his motion a little bit, and I think this is a little better. We still have a lot of work to do. Obviously, his head, hand is going inside his head because the prairie dog has a much bigger head than the human does, and so on. So there are lots of remaining challenges here. We have to deal with the collisions caused by the new body shape. I think that's actually relatively straightforward to do. There are a lot of characters we'd like to animate where the human kinematics, I'll get you in a second, the human kinematics don't have very much to do with, sorry, the kinematics of our cartoon character don't have that much to do with human kinematics, so we need a way to amplify the things that the person is able to do. Scaling for dynamics, which is one version of that was what was happening in the last, and adapting for a strength model is are two things we'd also like to do. So there are lots of things animals can do that a person can't do, you know, a cat jumping up onto a table. It has to do with its the strength and its hindquarters and so on. So we'd like to be able to try and figure out how to amplify the human motion in some reasonable way. So you had a question.
Yeah,